Hello, everybody. Welcome to Minimum Wage, the 99% need a raise. This is Conference on World Affairs, panel 5704. It's Friday, April 14th, 2017 at 3 p.m., and we're in the UMC West Ballroom. I'm Janet Beardsley, moderator for this panel. I'm a longtime Boulder resident, hold an MPA from Harvard Kennedy School, and recently retired from 30 years of service as the executive director of the YWCA Boulder. With us are our panelists today, Michael Frank, Mike, and Pia Arrhenius. Michael is the director of Washington, D.C. Programs and Research Fellow at the Hoover Institution. Michael received his law degree from Georgetown University. He previously worked as counsel for House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy and served in senior staff positions at the Heritage Foundation and the U.S. Department of Education. Pia Arrhenius is Vice President and Senior Economist, Research Department for the Federal Reserve Bank in Dallas, an adjunct professor at Baylor University in the Senior Executive MBA program. Pia received her PhD in economics from UCLA. Pia has published extensively on the economics of immigration, and she previously served as the senior economist on the Council of Economic Advisors under President George W. Bush. The format for today's panel on the minimum wage is as follows. We will have 15 minutes total for both panelists to present their opening statements, which is about 7 minutes per panelist. Then we will have 15 minutes for the panelists to respond to each other and listening to their comments or anything that they want to add further to their presentation. And then we will have 15 minutes for questions. There are two ways to pose a question. One is through the Conference on World Affairs app, which will appear, any questions will appear on my iPad. And the other is to write out questions on note cards that will be handed to you from the producers of this panel. And then I will read those questions out loud. Students have priority for asking questions, so please identify yourself if you are a student. Please formulate your comments and opinions into appropriate questions for the panelists to respond to. This panel will end at 3:50 p.m., and thank you. And let's get started. Mike?
Thank you. Well, you guys are the most enduring, persevering group in the entire CWA week here. I'm not sure whether to congratulate you or wonder aloud about your sanity, but 3 o'clock on a Friday, here you are. Thanks for being here. Minimum wage issues seem to arise in some kind of periodic nature. There's years and years at a time when you don't, if you're working in the policy realm, especially like me on the domestic side, when it doesn't really emerge, but then something seems to happen, and there's an effort to, update or expand the scope of those laws. I am a real cynic and critic of those laws up front. I'll tell you that, and let me explain some of the reasons why I have problems with them, and maybe a little bit about the history, the lineage of these laws is important to understand as well, because I think the original understanding of minimum wage laws reflects some of the economic critiques of them coming from more on the free market side. So my initial hesitation with the minimum wage laws and whether they're at the state level or at the federal level is that I think they substitute the judgment of government officials for the individual with respect to maybe the best way to seek an opportunity to exercise some upward mobility and to attain things that have a real value to the worker that may not show up on the ledgers as a wage. So, for example, getting a job that teaches the young worker, for example, how to be at work on time, how to get experience with certain skills and in office or a plant or a store, fill in the blank, whatever the job site is, to get networks, to get some adults, let's say if it's a younger person, to an older experienced people to see them work, supervise their day-to-day, and become a source of recommendations and the suggestions for future jobs in other places that would be upwardly mobile. Some people would value that and a lower wage than a higher wage that is very, very risky and maybe not even available in the first place. Sometimes when you set the wage too high, obviously you're crowding people out of the job market. And I mean, I think a good exercise to have when you're talking to someone who's really advocating much higher minimum wages is, okay, if it's 15 an hour, would you go to 16? Let's have a bidding here. Let's have an auction. Would you go to 17, 18, 19? At some point, would you stop? And if so, why? What would cause you? What's the dollar amount that would cause you to say, you know, that's not a good idea? Okay, I think that's a valid exercise to go through, because I think whenever you get to that point, I don't think you get to say infinity, but whenever you get to that point, you've reached your own economic determination that wage level is going to incur more harm than good. A little bit about the origins of minimum wage laws. I would direct you to a book that covers a lot of this stuff. It's called Illiberal Reformers, written by the author's last name is Reynolds at Princeton. Came out about a year or two ago. It's a short book, but it covers sort of a look at the original thinking that led to eugenics. Eugenicism, I guess, is maybe the term. And a lot of this was turn of the century, 1880s and 90s, university presidents, the early presidents of the American Economic Association, who formulated a lot of these theories. And the motivation for it was an animus toward three groups of people. Immigrants, mostly those from China. China was a special category of animus. They didn't want Chinese workers in the country then. Immigrants from most places, but especially the swarthy types of immigrants from southern parts of Europe, they didn't like them. And African-American migrants coming from the south, mostly to northern cities, where a lot of these university presidents and economists and so on were living. Woodrow Wilson was one of these people. And they felt that there were too many of these undesirables who they felt, if you look at this same book, goes into great depth looking at the textbooks at the time that looked at all the so-called races, the six races of Europe and so on. They were dividing people into these racial categories and attributing levels of intelligence, levels of skill, different kinds of character traits based upon whether you were from Serbia or from Italy or from Sweden or from China or wherever. And it was pretty nasty stuff. But back then, there was no real social, sanction against saying these things and writing these things. So this poor guy did all the research. It must have been pretty excruciating to read all those books and those textbooks and so on, and the annual proceedings of the American Economic Association and that sort of thing. But he did, and it's tough reading, but it's there. And minimum wage is one element of how this stuff manifested itself. And the thought was you had to keep these people out of the labor force so that white people, the preferred categories of white people, could get these jobs. So one way to do that is to set a wage higher than what they determined through their expert models and calculations was the real wage value, the labor value of these different groups. And then you set the minimum wage at a higher level than that to exclude them. Okay? And that's what states, progressive states of that era started to do. The early minimum wage laws came out of that kind of intellectual fermentation. There's something that was passed in Congress in 1931, still on the books and now revered by the union movement, called the Davis-Bacon Law. And Davis-Bacon was the efforts of a fellow from, I think it was Alabama, who was an overt racist, and a guy from Long Island who was also an overt racist, who didn't want black-owned contracting firms to get federal contracts, and because they were going to be able to underbid the union-level wages. So they wanted a limit placed on what kind of firms could get contracts and subcontracts to do, highway projects, bridge projects, whatever was being built during those years. And the only firms that could bid, they had a prevailing wage formula, that set the wages pretty high. It was basically a union wage became the de facto default. So the union-owned firms got it, and they tended to be all white, and they had exclusionary policies as well. And that was the lineage of that law, which is still periodically litigated on the House and Senate floors to no avail, because it's taken on a different coloration over the years in terms of its purpose, and people have long forgotten the racist lineage of that. So, but I think the key point in telling you that story is that the very notion of excluding people, in other words, that the minimum wage set at the right level prevents some people from working, was at the root of this concept. And I think it unfortunately remains kind of the root criticism. You know, it's still out there, it still happens, and if you set the wage too high, it becomes meaningful, and usually in a negative way for people. If you set it too low and you don't affect anybody, I'm all for it. But my problem is when you're starting to legally make it a crime, you're making it a crime to accept a job below a certain wage. And that's the problem you run into, I think, with the especially entry level. Now, where are we today on all this stuff? There's efforts in Congress to raise it. There was a bill a couple years ago to make it $10.10, and then I think they had some minimum wage bills at 12, and now there's one introduced this Congress at 15. And if you calculate, you know, different markets of the country, if you're in rural Arkansas or Alabama or someplace like that, a $15 an hour wage is going to affect a lot of the workforce, and a lot of people will, for some employers, get priced out of the marketplace. If you do it in San Francisco, a very, very small percentage of workers are being paid below 15, so it's not that big of a deal in a high-cost labor market like San Francisco. But a lot of states have gone off on their own and set their own minimum wages higher than the federal level. And, you know, I'm more accepting of that, frankly, because there's more of a market test and people can vote with their feet. At federal level, you get stuck. Voting with your feet means you leave the country to get a job, and I think that's unfair. So I would even prefer that the states just let local jurisdictions do it. And if Montgomery County, Maryland, wants to make a real high minimum wage, so be it. But people might, instead of getting jobs there, get jobs in Fairfax County, Virginia, or in D.C. or whatever. The mayor of Baltimore on April 1st, and it was no April Fool's joke, she vetoed a city council increase in the minimum wage for Baltimore because she felt it would eviscerate employment among lower wage, lower skill workers in the city of Baltimore. So when you start doing the real world application of this, I think you run into some pretty ugly outcomes and affecting some people who really need a chance to get on their feet, move up, and move on. And there's other elements of this we can discuss. I'll stop right here and look forward to your questions.
Good job, Mike. From my point of view, it's pretty interesting in labor economics. I mean, the theory around minimum wages is very clear, but the empirical work, the results that people have seen when they take the theory to the data are all over the place. And there's very, you know, strong disagreements about among labor economists about the virtues of minimum wages. So the work I've done, I've done a little work with my co-author on looking at the impact of minimum wages, and obviously our point was to see whether there are these employment effects of minimum wages. So if you mandate minimum wages, will they result in people losing their jobs, basically? We found that yes, we found small negative effects on teenagers. Why teenagers? And that's a typical result for the literature. Teenagers, because they're really the least skilled, the least productive, they have the least education and the least work experience. So you would expect that if you raise the cost of labor, the least productive workers will be the ones that will be affected. Now, why might you not always see an effect? Well, first of all, minimum wages tend to go up when wages are rising anyway. So the first thing as a researcher, when you look at whether minimum wages will hurt employment, is you have to say, when was the last time we had a minimum wage increase, and how large is this minimum wage increase? And how does it compare to sort of the average wage in the marketplace for this type of low-skilled worker? And a lot of times what we say about the minimum wage increases is that they're not binding. So Mike gave the example of San Francisco maybe increasing the minimum wage there from, you know, 12 to 13 or 14 to 15. It's not going to be a binding increase because maybe market set wages are already at that rate. Then you're not going to see an adverse impact. Otherwise, you might. Like if you came to Texas, where I work, and you raise the minimum wage from what's at the federal minimum, which I guess is $7.25, and you raised it to $15, well, there would be a huge employment effect. You might see employers reduce their workforce. You might see them reduce the hours that their workers work as well. You see them look for more productive workers. So in our paper that we did looking at what happened with these teens, we saw that employers reduced the employment of teens and increased their employment of immigrants that were a little bit older. So they substituted 16 to 18-year-old teenagers for 18 to 24-year-old immigrants in our paper. That was one of the results, which was interesting because it seemed like they were moving into people that have more work experience to sort of justify the higher labor cost. The other knock-on effects, if you have these binding increases in minimum wage, as Mike pointed out, it raises the cost of the industries where these people are employed, and so it may raise the prices for the consumers. And so to the extent it affects, for example, the fast food industry, that's also where a lot of low-income people eat. So you might even have effects where, you know, you reduce employment opportunities for the least skilled and then you increase the prices of the goods that they consume by affecting, you know, businesses like those. The last criticism really that I think is important of minimum wage laws is that as a poverty program, it's very ineffectual. It's very poorly targeted at poor people. So to the extent that you want to use the minimum wage to assist people that are low income, it's one of the worst tools because most of the minimum wage workers are not actually living in poor households. So there's other tools that we have that are much better targeted at alleviating, you know, as income support, much better programs than the minimum wage.
You had a schedule there. That's great. All right. Well, would the two of you like to talk a little bit?
That was good. We need more diversity of thought in this conference. I just don't understand it. Yeah.
They're coming in. The questions.
I'll throw one more thing on the table, too, that might reflect some of the politics behind minimum wage advocacy. What I recall, and I wasn't able to quantify it, maybe Pia knows the more of the details, but a lot of union contracts are set as a percentage of minimum wages. It could be 200, 300, whatever percent of a local minimum wage. So every time the minimum wage goes up, then the union contract goes up with it. And I forget how many unions were affected by that, but there was a time when I was doing this for a former House Majority Leader I worked for two of them, he was very involved in the minimum wage battles. And one of the things we were learning as we were doing the research back then was how many kind of ripple effects there are of increase in the minimum wage itself, so that some of the people advocating for it are just trying to get kind of a subtle backdoor salary increase in a field that might pay $30, $40, $50 an hour. So anyway, that's one point. And the other thing I'll just mention is, well, you mentioned the literature, Pia. There's been some fun research done periodically of economic textbooks, some of which have been written by very prominent academics who wearing their commentary hats are all in favor of minimum wage increases, but when you see what they actually wrote in their textbooks, they were talking about exactly what Pia was pointing out, some of the negative labor market effects and so on and so forth. And I remember back when I did this, it was about 20 years ago, when Congress was considering a minimum wage, Larry Summers was a prominent Treasury official in the Clinton administration. Turns out his textbook that was used at Harvard had a wonderful passage about the negative impact of the minimum wage that was circulated pretty widely at the time. And I believe even Paul Krugman's textbook had the same kind of warning about minimum wage laws. So, you know, sometimes when you put on your hat as an expert economist, well-trained and all that, you're going to say one thing, but, you know, in the heat of the battle on an MSNBC segment, you might say, oh, yeah, we need this. So anyway.
So I can elaborate on. So when I get in these discussions with my colleagues who like the minimum wage, what do they tell me? So they say, for example, the minimum wage, you know, the employment effects are small, and teenagers should be in school anyway. So that's one thing they tell me. So that's true. I mean, that, you know, the incidence of teenagers working, if you look over time, teenagers today are much, much less likely to work than they were 20 years ago, 30 years ago, or even 10 years ago. So teenagers don't typically work like they used to. So that's true. And if you have a higher minimum wage, that should encourage training and education, right? Because you need more education, you need to be a more productive employee in order to get a job at a higher wage. So that's the other argument that proponents of minimum wage say. They also say that we have to do something about income inequality, which is true, but they say that the minimum wage is one way to address income inequality and fight poverty, and lastly, and basically they don't think that the employment effects are really that big. So,
one final add-on. Pia mentioned how you can better target, if your goal is to help people who are working poor get a salary increase or wage supplement of some sort. The earned income tax credit is an example where it's targeted by family structure, by income, and it can be up to, I think it's over $6,800 a year as a total when you max out, up in an add-on to your salary. So if the real goal is to help a single mom with two kids who's working at the minimum wage, the EITC targets that person but does not target the teenager or the young person working, you know, in a where the family income is six figures in the suburbs and they're working somewhere at the mall. Do they really need the same minimum wage, relatively speaking? They're getting the training, they're getting the experience, that's fine. But you may end up hurting some of the jobs in that same place where the other worker alongside that teenager from the affluent home is a single mom with two kids. So you want to give her a chance to get a supplement. You can do that through something like the Earned Income Tax Credit Program.
Let's go to all those questions. All right. Well, I do have a lot of questions. You guys are active out there. I'm going to start with the students, and then if you've identified yourself as a student, some of you, when you have asked a question, have wanted it to be directed one way or another. If not, I'm just going to read it out there, and we'll go from there. Okay. So the question is from a student, what about impoverished citizens or immigrants?
Yeah, the last thing I said, I would just reiterate that you can find ways to target income supplements to people through something like the Earned Income Tax Credit. Now, the caveat to all those programs is that there's a negative kind of job impact as the person's income starts to go up and they begin to phase out of that benefit. So as they earn extra money, they're not just paying whatever taxes are owed on those extra dollars earned, but they're also losing money they previously had received. So the EITC amount will drop from $6,800 to $5,800 to $4,800 as their income goes up. So in a way, the net gain of getting another $1,000, say, of income is a lot less than just your income minus your taxes. You're going to lose, in some cases, food stamp benefits, your housing subsidies. You can lose a whole lot of things at the same time, and there's a kind of a poverty trap effect that we have never figured out a way to deal with properly. But the EITC, at least for the people in the 20 to maybe 40,000 range, 15 to 40,000 range, is actually a much more targeted, equitable way to get the help to the people who really, really need it.
I would agree with that again, to properly target the working poor, the Earned Income Tax Credit is a much better tool for that. Now, I'm not sure all immigrants would qualify for the Earned Income Tax Credit. Yes, so, you know, it's good to have a floor, a minimum wage out there. There should be a floor just to protect workers more generally. You just have to be leery of, you know, large increases in that floor, because that's when you start seeing some of those detrimental effects that we talked about earlier. I did want to mention, you know, there's a lot of other problems that impede So the working poor from working as much or and it's not just the going wage, so it can be other things like childcare, transportation, health. There's So in terms of when it comes to the working poor or people who are poor who want to work, there's a lot of other impediments, and it's not just the going wage rate. And I think that policymakers have to think about everything else that affects a person's ability to work. And it's not just, the going wage rate.
Again, from a student, isn't it better to have the poor spend more money to stimulate the economy?
Yeah. And that requires that they have jobs. And if you're going to do things that are well-intended but inadvertently shrink the pool of those kinds of jobs, they won't have any money to spend, nor will they have a job.
How are people expected to get up and get on their feet if they can't afford the many things that are imperative to living better and moving forward?
I think that, in terms of wages more generally, and I think that's this question speaks more generally to income inequality and the disparity that we see in wages in the labor market, and not just per se to minimum wages. It's just the problem with the market economy, is that if we could be sort of social planners and we could say we want everyone to be able to afford everything, we're going to set wages at a certain level and prices at another level so that people can buy the things that they want. I mean, the economy just doesn't work that way. You get these distortions in labor supply and labor demand and in product markets when the government tries to interfere by setting prices and wages. So I think that there's other ways that we can address some of these questions rather than trying to regulate prices. I mean, I would say things like, whether it's, and maybe this could generate some disagreement here with Mike, so like health benefits, if we had the government, expand Medicaid or have, everyone, so you wouldn't have to go to work to get health benefits, perhaps. Those types of things, because I think there's a lot of other issues going on. Like I mentioned earlier, child care is one. And I think to the extent, what can government do to address those other issues?
The question in a way presumes that we're talking about people who are poor and not poor individually within a larger context of a family, right, that has a lot more money. So when you look at the minimum wage earners, you could, in that question, extract and exclude, again, like the, someone who maybe had been raising kids at home for a while goes back into the workforce and just getting started at a minimum wage job, but there's a spouse making a lot of money that, puts them in a different category than someone whose entire well-being is contingent upon what they can earn and what kind of benefits they can get out of an employer at work. But it seems to me at the end of the day, like a $15 an hour wage, I think I sort of calculated, requires the worker to bring about $38,700 a year in value to the employer. So if you can meet that kind of a market test, the job will be there for you. And it may not even, and the question then becomes, that if that's just what the basic wage has to be, what if you're mandating on top of that healthcare, childcare, transportation, subsidies or fill in the blank? You're suddenly saying that worker, in order to get the minimum wage job, has to be worth maybe $50,000 or $55,000 a year. And then you're starting to see some problems, because an entry-level worker, in many cases, will not be able to meet that particular test. And then we've created inadvertently a problem for those people in those categories.
Could you discuss why or why not a minimum wage pegged to the cost of living would or would not work? Would this more resemble a living wage?
So wages pegged to the cost of living, that's typically, there are countries that do that, but typically that's where the cost of living is increasing rapidly. And I think this would probably just contribute to wage inflation, and it's typically not done in sort of advanced economies where we try to control inflation. So you want wages to rise with the productivity of workers. So the best way really to raise wages is for workers to be more productive, which usually comes from having more education, more training, and more experience.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, that's good.
Okay, this was directed to you, Mike.
Uh-oh.
Okay. How do you propose dealing with income inequality?
I'm not sure, aside from you want the economy to be able to grow as fast as it can. We've had a big increase in income inequality in the last few years with relatively slow growth of economic, GDP growth. So I think that's because most of that spread in the inequalities come from more the wealthy having more in the way of investments and equity, but also property values having gone up for those who can afford to own a piece of property. Wages have not matched that in any way, shape, or form. So there's that, you know, that growing gap. There's some people who are really upset about this, want there to be wealth taxes and all that sort of thing. I just think the more we can unshackle the restraints on economic growth and get back up to something like 4%, 3.5%, 4%, then that's going to solve a lot of those kinds of problems and give people who depend upon wage income a chance to earn more and save more and start reaping the benefits of other things like property ownership and investment in equities.
Anything you want to respond to that?
Question
for you.
Okay. I think the best way to address income inequality is to address, we talked about this in a session on Wednesday, is to address education, make sure there's, everyone has equal access to good quality education, that the schools are doing a good job. I think that's really the root cause, or the fundamental way to address income inequality is to do a better job with schools and educating our kids. And I did want to throw some water on Mike's 4% growth, which I think in light of the impending demographic bust that we're entering into in terms of the U.S. workforce and the retirement of the baby boomers, I don't think we'll be able to grow 4% no matter what. But
I remain the most optimistic man in America.
All right. This is for Pia. What are the anti-poverty programs that work better than minimum wage? You mentioned that earlier. Could you expound upon that?
I agree with Mike on that about the earned income tax credit, because that actually allows the government to see the structure of your family, your earnings, and your working, your income, and so then they kick back it's a negative income tax, which just basically means that if you're working and if you're really basically the working poor, then the government will pay you extra to work. And so the beauty of the earned income tax credit is that it rewards work. So it's not like a traditional welfare program, which, you might say rewards you for staying home, but the earned income tax credit rewards work. And the good thing is that if you're in the workforce and you have a job, then, that as you build on that work experience, then you will earn higher wages in the future. And so there's just a lot of knock-on positive effects from that.
The one thing I would just add is, licensing laws are a real impediment to entry-level workers, low-wage workers, from acquiring experience, starting their own businesses, and moving up. And a lot of states require massively expensive and unnecessary training to get certain licenses. And there's studies that have compiled a list of all the occupations that now require licenses. And one of the problems with that is those are state-only. So if you spend 2 years going through one program, they get a license to braid hair or do, hairstyling or something like that, then you have to move. You have to go back to square one and start that whole process again. If you're a low-wage worker trying to make ends meet, something like that, maybe even out of your house, that's a real big burden on being an entrepreneur. One way that some people have started to get at the cross-state problem is noticing that military families are especially affected by that because of all their deployments going from one base to another. So, do you relieve that burden on someone who's a veteran or a member of an active military family who's going from one assignment to another, but not everybody else? I think it's a good point, a good principle. It could be expanded to everybody in those low-wage categories.
Okay, we have two questions here that are very similar from students. And basically what both of these students are asking, they're saying that they have had to work and work really hard to get to school and to help support themselves. One wants to go on to be a lawyer, and the other one is coming from the Western Slope and is trying to go to school as well. And how do you help teens and young people if this minimum wage situation continues to exist where they get the least amount of money and are working to try to go to school, support their families? What's your response to that?
Again, I think in terms of education, it's probably better to subsidize education and tuition than it is to try to mandate wages in the labor market. So that's probably what I would do, is advocate for better targeted education subsidies, whether it's, you know, some form of student loans or grants, that type of thing, rather than try to set wages and prices.
Yeah, we all have to start somewhere, and if you're going to school and you're getting one of your first or your second job, I can still remember great details about my earliest jobs and what they entailed and what happened, because they made a huge impression on me and they shaped me in a very fundamental way. So getting those jobs, even if they seem like they're not, you know, the most useful utilitarian jobs or educational jobs in the world, they can be. And you can really make a name for yourself with your employers. And again, you get your references, you get your I get applications all the time for internships and that sort of thing, and a lot of the resumes have that those employments with some, you know, boathouse or restaurant or some job like that, and they list the references. I mean, that's important. You can see that the experience was a good one, and the employer is willing to recommend and so on. So I, you know, belly up to the bar, work really hard, study hard, get the degree. And then you can tell your stories later on when you're a lawyer or whatever you're going to be doing, making a decent salary and earning a living, supporting a family. You know, I started out making X amount an hour in such and such a restaurant, and by gosh, you've got to do that too. I mean, is this the path people have to take now to, and always really, to get ahead?
I think a good example of what to watch out for is really to look at like Western Europe, for example, where there's a lot of, not all those countries have minimum wage laws, but they have a lot of labor regulation around certain occupations, industries. They mandate a lot of benefits. So the labor costs are very, very high. And that's where you see youth unemployment rates are outrageous, to the point of 30-40% youth unemployment as a result of this, and even worse among immigrants. So that's just sort of an example that I hope can demonstrate, the higher the labor cost, the more difficult it'll be to find a job if you're a low educated or a low wage worker with little experience.
As Michael mentioned, minimum wage laws were implemented to exclude unwanted races. Are people of color currently affected more adversely from increasing minimum wage?
Well, to the extent that they're in the affected income classes, they certainly are, and I think that's probably the case. I think they'd also disproportionately benefit from things like the EITC, because I think you have a greater percentage of Hispanic and African American households that have incomes that are in that EITC range. So, again, I think if you target this properly, you can accomplish some of the goals of the folks that want an across-the-board blanket minimum wage increase.
In the research that we've done, we certainly saw that minority teens were the ones that were adversely affected. So we looked specifically at black and Hispanic teens, and that's where we saw the bulk of the employment effect of the minimum wage.
So there have been lots of questions coming in about how do immigrants and young people learn about these different tax benefits when there are language and citizenship barriers? There have been several questions to that effect.
Well, imagine if it's a very, you know, obscure by American standards language, and very few people speak it. It's going to be hard to get any kind of information about anything, including the television schedule. So, you know, but for the most part, what I see is there's an increasing number of translated versions of government documents. I don't know how many languages now, but again, you know, that's not every country translates everything it produces officially into multiple languages. So I'm not sure what the answer is to that.
I mean, I think there's a lot of legal services out there and tax services for immigrants, which are probably helpful. And then I use TurboTax. TurboTax always tells me, oh, you're going to get this benefit. Although it usually tells me, oh, you don't qualify for this benefit.
Right. It's not a friendly one.
Okay, on to another question. Pensions are disappearing. Healthcare costs are out of control. Please address income equality in the context of the title of this session. The 99% need a raise.
Well, I guess this is getting beyond the minimum wage. I mean, this is, again, where, you know, you have it, you look at some of the numbers for whether it's our economy or some of the social metrics, like we talked about before, things like disability rolls or, you know, student debt. There's a whole range of things that I think we've been stuck on for over a decade, actually going back pretty much to the turn of the century. There's a piece that I think was in Commentary magazine by I think it's Nick Eberstadt called Our Miserable 21st Century, and he in great detail chronicles these trend lines, and it's not just the last 8 years, this really goes back before then, and it manifests itself in all kinds of negative ways, including some lower mortality rates in certain demographic groups in America, notably whites between 45 and 54. And those are called, those deaths are called deaths of despair. There's consequences to that. There's always a consequence to, you know, when something doesn't work out and someone drops out of the workforce, gets on disability, that's going to exacerbate income inequality, right? I mean, there's all kinds of, you know, when you look at something that happens very frequently now, which is what one social scientist called a sort of mating, where one kid from one affluent family marries into a kid from another affluent family, they go to affluent school, you know, elite schools, they get elite occupations, they have kids. Yeah, that happens with a lot of frequency. You're going to get those households or multiplier effects on inequality. As one expert said on civil rights, that Harvard University used to be a school with a whole lot of rich kids, and some of whom happen to be smart, and it's because of the ability of things like the College Boards to select and segregate people according to cognitive skills. Harvard now is a school full of really, really smart kids, some of whom happen to be rich. And when they all meet each other and socialize together and start dating, you know, that's done with much more efficiency, so to speak, in an economic sense, than was the case 30, 40, 50 years ago. And I think that probably shows up in these statistics. You get these gated communities, you get these, you know, super zip codes, as Charles Murray called them, where the numbers are off the charts in terms of incomes and educational attainment. You have helicopter parents that are spending massive amounts of their fortunes to get their kids to get into Harvard and Yale and Stanford and wherever else, and University of Colorado Boulder. So I think that's part of it. I don't know how you reverse that. That's a societal-wide dynamic that's been at work for a while, and some of you in this room are probably responsible for it, right? And it's for your personal lives, it's a very good thing. And there's a lot more segregation by economic standards in places like Appalachia and elsewhere that used to be the case. You know, read the Hillbilly Elegy book, which is a really interesting depiction of how that works out. And this one fellow, he escaped that. And he was working, ended up getting out of Yale Law School from a tough family background. He ended up in Silicon Valley. And he's more recently moved back to his town in a low-income part of Ohio to try to do something about it, you know. I don't know what the solution is, aside from, you know, not letting really, really smart, wealthy, affluent people marry other wealthy, affluent people. You want to try that one out?
Pia, do you have anything you want to say?
This session is getting really difficult and complicated. And so it's hard to answer these questions. So I don't know. So just thinking outside the box, what would I do? You know, to try to address what actually is the person asking the question is exactly right. It's a growing problem, and it's really getting at, it's corrosive. You know, it's getting at the very heart of what we stand for. So I think, so I was just thinking, there's some, where could we get money, like, to, you know, to funnel toward poor working class families to try to, you know, solve some of these problems once and for all? So there are some examples of, and these came up the other day in the income inequality session, there are some examples of really bad tax policy, which really amounts to middle class, you know, welfare, handouts to the rich. So what's one example? The mortgage interest tax deduction, which we all benefit from as homeowners, but we probably don't deserve that. I mean, we probably don't need it, most of us. And yet it's, I don't know, maybe Mike knows how much money it is. It's huge.
I think it's over $200 billion a year in tax expenditure.
$200 billion a year in middle-class welfare. So I would take the mortgage interest tax deduction away. What else would I take away? Well, healthcare benefits that employers pay are tax deductible also. Well, the research shows that the mortgage interest deduction raises the price of housing, and that the healthcare tax deduction raises the cost of healthcare. So I would take that away too. And then with the money I had left over, I think I'd just go ahead and implement universal healthcare. How about that?
And let's build off that last point, right? Most countries that do universal health care spend about 10 or 11% or less of their GDPs on health care. We spend about 19. Here's the deal. If you want to go to universal health care, you're willing to cap health care expenditures nationwide at 11% of GDP and let people like me spend the other 8% of GDP on tax cuts and other things? Or do you think we need a national health care system that spends at 19% of GDP? That's dangerous. That's scary. And I don't think there's any country in the world that does that. So you'd be in uncharted territory. But that's the unstated trade-off in all this, because people point to these countries and say, what a great system, and it's wonderful. Okay, well, it's like half of our cost. What do we do? Are we going to take our cost down to the level of Canada or the level of those European countries? If so, I'm all with you, and we can have a lot of fun with that 8% of GDP. You know what 1% of GDP is? It's like something like $190 billion a year. Multiply that by 8. So you guys are good at math, right? It's going to be a trillion something, right? Have fun with that. We could do a lot of society, but I don't know what the quality of the healthcare would be if we're cutting our expenditures in half, and you have a whole lot of angry hospital administrators.
Okay, we have one last question before we have to close up for the day. But because this is the last session, I don't know if our panelists are willing to stick around and have some of the questions that I didn't get to.
Only if you bring your own some martini mix. Then I'll hang around for a while.
And I want to thank our producers. Wave your hands back there. You guys have been very, very helpful today. Thank you very much. So many questions on this subject. So I'm just going to use this one as an example. Lots and lots of questions about CEO salaries. So here we go. What are the key factors over the last 20 to 30 years that have contributed to stagnant wages for the majority of workers while CEO salaries have grown significantly?
You want to take a crack at that, or I can try? Yeah. I'll give it a shot. It's I think the argument would be that the size and scale, if you look at like the top, the Fortune 500s, if the CEO's wisdom adds a certain amount of value to that company, the multiplier effect, because of the scale of the company and profits and all that, makes that salary worth a whole lot more. And I think, you know, maybe even like things like professional sports. I remember when there was a big fight between, you know, Mickey Mantle and Willie Mays, where one guy got 130 a year, the other one got 125, and there was headlines about that, you know? And there's a famous story of Ruth, you know, getting paid 100 a year and telling the president he had a better year than he did, so he deserved more money. Now they're getting paid $20-25 million a year. I'm not sure what the economics of that is, but it seems like it works overall for Major League Baseball, although you have to take out a loan to take your family to a game anymore. But I think that's the nature of it. I don't know. At the end of the day, there are boards of directors and all that. I'd be curious to know what kind of pattern there is in the privately held firms that are family-owned for the most part. Do they take out more money on average than the publicly held ones? That might be an interesting dichotomy to find.
Yeah, I mean, I think that looking at CEO salaries, you know, I don't think it's that relevant to the bigger issues and the bigger problems and the root problems of, you know, what we're, the things we're talking about, income inequality and poverty and so forth. I think CEOs are, there's very few of them, and so it's sort of a distraction rather. I think just get back to basics, you know, get rid of those tax loopholes. We have a pretty high marginal income tax rate. I think it's 39.5%. I mean, if you get, yes. And so get rid of the tax loopholes, you know, make full use of that marginal tax rate. And I think that's how you get them.
There were many questions I didn't get to, and I apologize for that. I just didn't have enough time. But I thank you all very much, and I'm sure our panelists will stick around and answer your questions if you'd like to come up and ask them. Thank you very much for coming.